Hello and welcome to The World This Week. It's been a week that's seen a ceasefire brokered in Lebanon. A six-week truce between Israel and Hezbollah began Wednesday morning, leading to an almost immediate gridlock of the country's coastal roads as thousands headed south, despite military orders that it wasn't safe yet. The truce lies uneasy so far, accusations of violations on both sides, but President Biden struck a hopeful tone.
This is designed to be a permanent cessation of hostilities. What is left of Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations will not be allowed, will not be allowed to threaten the security of Israel again.
And it's been a week of Trumponomics dominating the headlines, with the president-elect settling an ultimatum, essentially, to neighboring Mexico and Canada: stop migrants and drugs from entering the US or face heavy tariffs. Then a he said, she said moment. Donald Trump said Mexico had agreed to close the border. It was a wonderful conversation, but not true, said the Mexican president, who hit back.
Por ejemplo, de los principales exportadores de México, Estados Unidos son General Motors, Stellantis y Ford Motor Company, las cuales llegaron a México hace 80 años. ¿Por qué ponerle un impuesto que las ponga en riesgo?
And it's been a week where Germany's former leader has set the record straight, Angela Merkel releasing her memoir called Freedom, wanting, she said, to shape her own legacy. The criticism since her time in office has grown, with questions over her migration strategy, economic decisions and relations with Vladimir Putin. In it, she makes no apologies and said that she was made a scapegoat for the war in Ukraine.
It doesn't make any sense now that I simply say I got everything completely wrong. And now it's like scales falling from my eyes. That's not the case.
Welcome to the programme on this Black Friday special. Four issues this week for the price of three. And with us in the studio, France 24 senior international correspondent Catherine Norris-Trent. Catherine, I was going to start with asking you about your week, but it's been a particularly significant week for you.
Well, it was actually. I got the news via a news agency, not through any legal system, that the Russian court has decided to issue an arrest warrant for me because of some of my reporting with Ukrainian troops in the Russian region of Kursk. So it wasn't unexpected news, but nonetheless, you know, it comes as a blow, and it just shows their attitude towards press freedom and any news that embarrasses them. Basically, they try and clamp down on, I guess. I'm just the latest case of that.
A number of Western journalists, they've done the same thing with.
Absolutely. But anyone who's crossed and reported into Kursk, they do that with them. So it wasn't unexpected, like I say, but it just shows that the limits that they put on reporting, they themselves, by the way, have taken journalists inside areas of Ukraine that they occupy. So, you know, there's hypocrisy in this as well.
Does it hit you with some concern, a concern for yourself, your own self, and concern for where you can go, where you can report?
Well, yeah, where I can go without being extradited to Russia. So it does limit my movement somewhat, but I'm determined to continue reporting. And it feels just like press intimidation, but I'm determined to keep going.
Catherine, great to have you with us. Well, also with us, let's go to London. Yasmin Abdul-Majeed, broadcaster, social advocate, author of several books, including Talking About a Revolution, which, Yasmin, you've called a coda to your 20s, which is fascinating. Tell us about what you mean.
Well, the essay collection spans about 10 years of writing. About half of, you know, half I wrote throughout my 20s and then the second half when I turned 30. And it charts my political evolution. It speaks briefly about what's happening in Sudan. But ultimately, what I wanted to do was to demonstrate that we don't arrive at our politics fully formed, and to be quite honest and transparent about that, because sometimes I think we can sort of give people the side eye when we don't think they're on the level that we think they should be. But actually, we all kind of grow and change as we learn, and also as life experiences change us.
I also try to keep up with you because you're doing something different almost every week. Since you were last on the programme, you've been selected, I understand, to be part of the team writing for Emmerdale, which is a British TV institution. How was it? And for international viewers, Yasmin, you may need to explain it as well.
Yeah, so for my friends, this was the sort of biggest pivot I could have done in my life, because imagine the most kind of bucolic, countryside British television continuing drama that you can imagine, and that is what Emmerdale is. And so I've been really lucky to spend the last few months up in Leeds, up in the north, with the writing team, learning the ropes, and my first episode will be going out very shortly, which is very exciting. So I can officially say that I've lived and worked in the north, which gives me quite a lot of credibility, I believe.
Chapeau to you, Yasmin. And also, let's go to Norfolk in the UK, because we're joined by Katja Hoyer, historian and author of Beyond the Wall, History of East Germany. So it's a great week to have you on, Katja, fellow of Royal Historical Society, and one of the relatively few people that can honestly say they have read the Angela Merkel memoir, all 750 or so pages, 27 hours as an audio version, and reviewed it for The Telegraph. Katja, did you have to sign secret documents swearing not to pass on key excerpts so you could read it before it was released this week?
Yeah, I did actually. There was a surprising amount of, sort of secrecy around this. It was only given to us sort of 10 days or so before it came out. So, it was a bit of a challenge to read the whole thing and review it for The Telegraph as well.
Is it a page turner?
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I learned a lot about the sort of historical events and the politics of the era and also Merkel's interactions with sort of fellow world leaders. But at the same time, it often feels like she's just taking you through her diary, really. And that could also be a little bit repetitive at times.
Right. We're going to get onto that, Katja, including what she says about Brexit, the disgrace, other world leaders, Putin, Donald Trump as well. Let's go to the US. Let's bring in Katie Drummond, the global editorial director of Wired magazine. Katie's previously led the global expansion of Vice News across Latin America, Europe, Asia, saw its digital transition as well. Katie, great to have you on the programme. And we note that you've recently introduced a politics section to Wired. Tell us the thinking behind that.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me. Wired launched its politics vertical about a year ago. This was in the run-up to, obviously, the federal election in the United States, but also recognizing that there were a record number of elections taking place around the world in 2024, and that it was my feeling and our feeling as a publication that you can no longer sort of unravel technology from politics, right? Whether we're talking about, you know, influencers on digital platforms who are campaigning for certain candidates, or the impact of generative AI in disseminating, you know, propaganda and misinformation, you know, across the internet. Now, what we're seeing, of course, with, you know, Elon Musk, you know, one of the most powerful people in the world, obviously a leading figure in the tech industry, sitting in the White House with Donald Trump, right? So we really felt like it was important for us as a publication about technology and about where the world is going to have a very close eye and sort of keep a close eye as reporters and journalists on what was happening, you know, at the intersection of politics and tech.
And we're going to get onto in a moment as well, in a short while, about Elon Musk this week publicising the names of some of those that effectively feel named and shamed, of those he might get rid of as part of his new duties at the heart of the government, the Doge Department. But let's begin with the news from Lebanon, a ceasefire, 4 o'clock in the morning, Lebanon time. A ceasefire coming into force, bringing an end, albeit temporary so far, to the 2-month Israeli land invasion, provoked by an almost year of rocket strikes by Hezbollah. It was a deal brokered by the US and France.
I just spoke with the Prime Minister of Israel and Lebanon. I'm pleased to announce that their governments have accepted the United States' proposal to end the devastating conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. I want to thank President Macron of France for his partnership in reaching this moment.
Another reason for having this peace now is to give our forces a break and let them replenish their stocks. And I say it openly, it is no secret that there have been big delays in weapons and munitions deliveries. These delays will be resolved soon.
Well, it led to remarkable scenes on Wednesday morning. Lines of cars, the coastal highway gridlocked, with those returning to their cities and villages in the south, families forced to flee because of the war, already driving back home, despite Lebanese and Israeli government warnings that it's not safe to do so yet. So this agreement, 60-day halt to the fighting, and during that time, Hezbollah is meant to move its fighters north of the Litani River. Well, that's about 30 kilometres north of the border with Israel. And as they do that, Israel will gradually withdraw its own troops from southern Lebanon back across the border into Israel. And the Lebanese army is meant to deploy thousands of soldiers to the region to ensure no one else has weapons south of the Litani River except the Lebanese army and UN peacekeepers. All of this monitored by five countries, led by the US, who review any alleged violations of the agreement. And then there's a separate side agreement between Israel and America, which gives the Israelis the right to strike back at what they describe as immediate threat emanating from Lebanon. Let's start with your thoughts on this, Catherine. It seems to be a moment that was a long time in the making and yet seems for now to be holding.
It seems to be holding. It's very fragile. I mean, we have had incidents of, you know, Israeli troops firing on targets, they say, in southern Lebanon, people they suspect of continuing Hezbollah activities. And they've been calling on people, obviously, not to go back to villages south of that line. So it's very, very fragile at the moment, but so welcome to people in Lebanon. When I was there reporting in October, you just saw the sheer upheaval that had been caused to a massive swathe of Lebanon's population. You know, more than 1 million people displaced in that small country, some of them who'd fled with nothing, basically sleeping on the streets, sleeping in schools, trying to find shelter wherever they could. It was causing some kind of community tensions. So those people are overjoyed to perhaps be able to head home. I think I'm a little wary about, you know, Joe Biden saying this is a permanent or lasting peace. On the same day, Netanyahu said that this could be a short ceasefire, warning they will strike hard against any Hezbollah plans to attack Israel. And of course, he's been facing public anger in Israel from some sections of society about people saying, look, they shouldn't have stopped now. They should have gone on to basically eliminate all of Hezbollah. So we really need to see how this plays out, although certainly it's much needed relief for the people of the region.
It is. Yasmin, what's your reading of this, the situation this week? Are you optimistic that it can last?
I think the question of whether or not this can last, it depends on, you know, as previously mentioned, the choices that are made by, you know, by Hezbollah, the remaining parts of Hezbollah, and also by the Israeli government. I think it is welcome relief. It is incredibly fragile. I do think that the rush to return demonstrates the Lebanese desire for things to go as back to normal as quickly as possible. I think it's also interesting to think about the fact that within the country from my anecdotal conversations, there is some sense that peace, any sort of peace, is welcome, and also the Hezbollah, the fact that numerous Hezbollah leaders have been killed, there is a real question as to what the state of Hezbollah will be like moving forward, and the actual choices they have to resist or push back against Israel at all. And so whether it might not just be the case that this ceasefire is fragile and ends because of a choice, but it might also be the case that, you know, the Hezbollah are not able to return or retaliate in the way that ultimately, I don't think people expected this to play out in the way that it did.
No, I think your point about kind of the assassination of the top level figures with Hezbollah and actually what happens next. So clearly, Catherine, there's this fear that amongst Israelis, the 60,000 or so that are still trying to return to the north, you mentioned the 1 million Lebanese that have had to flee from the south, that ultimately this goes back to a 2006 situation, that they end the war, they agree, as they've agreed this time, to this UN resolution 1701, the Litani River becomes the key factor removing Hezbollah from there, and it didn't happen. The Lebanese military simply didn't do the job. I just wonder, you touched also on Joe Biden, said, you know, his optimism there. Are there two ways of looking at this? One is international diplomacy, the effort. There's a kind of snowball effect right now to say you've done one, we can achieve the other big deal. And yet, if you look, and you've spent time in Tel Aviv, you've spent time in Jerusalem, if you look at the Israeli government right now, is this also a moment where Benjamin Netanyahu can look to say, well, we've stepped off in Lebanon, we can concentrate more in Gaza?
Yeah, I don't think we can equate the two situations. It doesn't, just because there's been this ceasefire for Lebanon doesn't mean that it's going to be the case at all in Gaza. I think Israel's military objectives were very different. I think they have a different timescale in mind. I think he was pushed to get this Lebanon ceasefire, obviously, not only by Biden administration, but by people close to the incoming Trump administration. And that's, you know, putting a layer of pressure on him there. It will be interesting to see how that plays out. I just think it might mean intensified pressure on the Gaza situation. You know, there was an Israeli minister, I think it was the Minister for Agriculture, who said that they're going to be there for some time. I mean, I know various members of the Israeli cabinet come out with various kind of statements, don't all toe the same line at all. But it's a very, very different situation. And of course, Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank are very worried about what comes next for them with the incoming Trump administration and what Netanyahu's government will decide to do if they don't feel they have any restraints at all on them now.
It's a very good point, actually, because you've talked about the elements of the government. It's on the right wing. The argument is the right wing element is emboldened by Donald Trump. There's already talk within the right wing. There's been operated tours that journalists have seen on the border of Gaza with a view to going back to settlements for Israelis as they were back in 2005 when they were evacuated. So that on the one hand, and a ceasefire, I guess, you've spent time looking at this politically for the government. For Netanyahu, the breakup of his coalition, well, there are big risks for him personally of what comes with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he's out of power, his career maybe not only ends, but he also has all these legal cases which are facing him. So it's a battle for survival, clearly. So it's this very delicate coalition to keep together. I wouldn't just say there were right-wing there, extreme right-wing members of his coalition who are very active in the settler movement, some of them, and who were, yeah, at this event just on the Gaza border, a couple of members of his government, including members of his own Likud party, talking about, yeah, colonising Gaza. Now, that isn't official policy. It's not what a majority of people in Israel say they want, but it's certainly very much out there in the public discourse now.
Katie, I'm just wondering about the delicate issue for where you are, for the UK government, for London, for Berlin as well, because this is a difficult role, I guess, to take on for Germany, to play, you know, essentially being the ally of Israel in this conflict, for the coalition government and now what's left of it that limps on, how it positions itself.
Yeah, this has always been an incredibly difficult sort of issue for Germany to balance.
Yeah.
I mean, really, its alliance with Israel has been at the heart of what first West Germany and now the United Germany is all about. So it's really made the security of Israel part of its reason of state, as the phrase has it. But at the same time, it also has to be seen to stand for the upkeep of international law and of sort of justice in the world, really. So trying to balance this out, being cautious about criticizing Israel, but also standing by its side, has been incredibly difficult. And in Berlin, we've seen some of the biggest pro-Palestinian demonstrations out there, really, in the last few months and weeks. And this has also been very, very difficult to police in Germany. So all of these things are raising huge moral issues for the country and the government.
Yes, how do you think the UK government is playing this? And notably here this week, particularly on the issue of the ICC arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu, the French government saying, well, actually, there's a case of diplomatic immunity because Israel's not a member of the Rome Treaty. It's not signed up, therefore, as a member of the ICC. London's been kind of cagey too, hasn't it, on its position vis-a-vis arresting or not Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, London has got a similar issue at the moment in that it's got a left-wing government, which basically within its own Labour Party has got left-wing wings, which are very much in support of Palestine and very, very vocal about that. But at the same time, they're trying to keep a sort of centre-left part of the party with it as well, which is sort of less critical of Israel, basically, than the far left wing of it, and holding the party together over this isn't easy for Keir Starmer.
Catherine, remind us of that, because I guess if you look at the focus of the French government talking about a diplomatic immunity applying, does that put you in an odd situation with Vladimir Putin, who also faces an ICC arrest warrant and isn't signed up?
About half the world is crying double standards over this, saying, you know, if international law applies, it should apply to everyone equally. And so I think the West in general has a big problem with this. You know, for a long time, they were trying to get the so-called Global South, or powerful countries, non-Western countries, to back their side in Ukraine. But then you have people saying, look, you're saying that this is important to uphold international law. And then you've had what's happened, the situation in the Middle East, and huge amounts of people in the Arab world, but not only, are saying, look, this is basically à la carte. The West is choosing how to interpret international law, as it always has done. It's been seen as winner's justice. And this is another example of this. So this is extremely difficult moral ground, I would say, for the West here.
Yasmin, how do you see this?
Yeah, I was nodding vigorously there because that's exactly right. I think it's very difficult. There's this sense that there's been a double standard for a long time, but this really pushes it to the surface. It makes it really difficult to look away from. And if there is this arrest warrant out, and you know, countries like France and perhaps maybe you know the UK turn around and choose not to make an arrest or not to sort of follow through on that, the sense of the quote unquote rule-based order or the international rule-based order, the Western liberal democratic status quo, it falls apart even more. And I think this is something that we're living through at the moment, especially with the election of Donald Trump, somebody who has his, you know, whose administration will have their own approach that he's not necessarily seen as someone who supports that sort of traditional, the kind of order that we've had for the last 40 or 50 years. And so I think we're at a real inflection point as a globalized society, and how the things play out over the next few years as Donald Trump comes to power will be very, very interesting.
Well, Yasmin, it's very interesting. It takes us also into another significant issue this week, because on Monday, the next American president started his week with textbook Trump moves straight from the art of the deal, or the art of the tariff in this case, his favourite word, a neighbourly message to Canada, a warning to Mexico, threatening that on day one of his presidency, he will impose a 25% tax on all goods coming to the UK from both borders, unless, he said on Truth Social, the two countries clamp down on drugs, particularly fentanyl, and migrants illegally crossing the border too. In a follow-up post, he said he was calling out Beijing as well, quote, for failing to follow through on its promise to carry out the death penalty for people caught dealing fentanyl, and so would impose extra tariffs on China until it stopped the flow of fentanyl. And his son, Eric, took to Fox News to expand and turned tariff into a verb.
You want to allow drugs to come through our southern border? We're going to tariff you. You want to allow them to come through Canada? We're going to tariff you. China, if you're going to allow this stuff to get sold in our country, largely produced in China, we're going to add another 10% to your tariff. We are going to cost your countries, your economies, we're going to cost your businesses billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. If you think you're going to poison Americans, it's not going to happen. You're not going to destroy our youth. You're not going to destroy our society. You're not going to destroy our families.
Well, by Wednesday night, an update from Donald Trump that he had, quote, a wonderful conversation with Mexico's new president, Claudia Sheinbaum, and that Mexico would close the border, stop migrants coming to the US. As you saw for a flash there, she said it didn't happen, didn't say it. That was the view from Claudia Sheinbaum. She said this, we reiterate the conversation that Mexico's position is not to close borders, but to build bridges between government and people. Well, let's start with this issue because, first of all, I think, Yasmin, we'll begin again with you. How would you assess Donald Trump's week, a week where the last two outstanding court cases against him, criminal cases, have been dropped as well?
It's quite interesting to think about going into this Trump presidency, because it is very different to 2016. I think in 2016 there was a lot of chaos, where now we've had this whole year worth of lead up, understanding the sort of policy positions that he potentially might take, and also an understanding of how Trump operates and all of the rhetoric that we've seen. We have to think about how much of it is bluster and how much of it will actually pan out. And there is the reality that there will be some part to this, you know, look at what he does and not just what he says, that will actually pan out. And with regards to tariffs, I mean, obviously he's deploying his family members to make all the rallying calls and so on Fox and such. But I do think that we're in for I don't want to use the phrase unprecedented times because I don't even know what times we're in anymore, but it will, it is not perhaps the thing to consider as we see all of this kind of froth and all of this very hyperbolic language using tariff as a verb, is how much of it will actually play out. That, I think, we will have to see come January 20.
Katie, in the catch here in Norfolk, I should say, tariffs, ultimatums, in your view, an effective strategy?
Well, I agree with Yasmin. We have to see what actually happens, what actually comes out of it. I mean, Donald Trump is very well known for basically preparing his so-called deals, in the sense that basically in his verbal rhetoric and the way that he uses his bluster, basically, it's a way of setting up your position. And so as a result of that, it's not entirely clear, you know, where the end position actually is, where he wants to end up. I think in Europe, it's interesting that there's a mix of both hope and fear about this. So from some people, I heard that they hope that this might revive the EU-American sort of trade deal that failed before, and that maybe there's a hope of reviving this or finding a way to get back to this. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who say, well, Europe will just have to sort of strengthen its own economy, since it may well be the case that trade deals and sort of trade in general between Europe and the US might become more difficult. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's a consensus yet as to where this leads.
Where it's heading. No, it's a good point. Katie Drummond, very interesting to note that in the past, well, this month, Wired has put out effectively a surveillance guide, how to deal with surveillance under administration of Trump 2.0 outside of your paywall. Tell us about that.
We have, yeah. It was actually one of the first stories we published after Donald Trump won the election in early November. You know, given all of the rhetoric and, you know, the point of you know, the other guests on the program is well phrased in that, you know, so much of this, you know, is to be determined, right? We need to see come January 20th, come the inauguration, what steps the Trump administration actually takes and how much of what he is saying now is just bluster. But look, Donald Trump has vowed to deport millions of people. He has vowed to crack down on press freedoms, on journalists across the country, among other threats, you know, among other rhetoric. And so we felt like it was really important for our audience to be armed with as much expertise and as much information as we could give them about how to protect themselves in a digital context, given sort of what Trump is saying now, although, of course, we don't know yet exactly what his administration will do. And for us, you know, we are a subscriber-based publication, so we rely on subscribers to fund our business and our journalism. But there are moments where we feel like the public service that we are offering is so important that we want to be able to provide that at no cost for anyone out there who might feel like they need to access that information. And so this is a great example where we made a decision. I ultimately made the decision to take the paywall off of this guide so that anyone, anywhere in the United States or around the world for that matter, could access this information and use it in their day-to-day life to protect, you know, their safety, the safety of family members, loved ones, so on.
It's very interesting as well, Katie, that we talked about Elon Musk a short while ago. So now at the heart of government, the world's richest man who has been, well, CNN heavily criticising this week a number of news agencies. They publicised the names and jobs of people on X that he's looking to cut as part of his Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. He's also come at Wired as well, hasn't he, on using X?
Yes, he has. Elon Musk has not had very kind things to say about Wired on X, the platform that he owns and where he has, you know, over 200 million followers. We also know, of course, that Elon Musk has actually changed the algorithm that powers X to disproportionately amplify his posts. So when you think about, you know, Elon Musk deciding to post something, whether he wants to say that Wired is a dead publication or he wants to publicize the names of, you know, federal employees whom he thinks should no longer have jobs at federal agencies, you know, the power in those statements, the reach of those statements to hundreds of millions of people, you know, we cannot sort of underestimate the potential risk and the potential implications of Elon Musk deciding to post anything on that platform.
It's very, very interesting. Just looking at the, there are so many implications of Elon Musk, Katia, in the UK. Give me your thoughts on what's happening with the UK government right now, because there's an odd thing here. First, have you got trade talks with Trump? His team have made clear, haven't they, that it's kind of a binary choice for the UK government, closer to Europe or go towards a US trade agreement. And at the same time, there's a leadership headache for Keir Starmer because Elon Musk has set his sights, it seems, on the UK. He's relentlessly critical right now of the UK government.
Yeah, that's right. And the UK government have got a problem in that they've, some of their ministers have been very, very critical of Donald Trump in the past. And so now they're trying to row back effectively, saying we're a sensible government, we're a trustworthy government, we're going to work with the US and make sure that this special relationship, as they still call it, with the US will not be sort of hampered by what people have said in the past. So there's that desire to prove that this relationship is still good and valid. But at the same time, it is a government that is inherently critical of what Donald Trump is going to do and is trying to stay true to itself as well. And that tension, I think, is very visible at the moment.
It's very interesting also just navigating this, Catherine, as a journalist. You know, there is such a divisive partisan feeling for traditional media, social media, and interacting with people. There's a kind of just dealing with a very new environment of bubbles, how people talk,
right,
what people, how people perceive things based on, are you supporting Donald Trump or not?
Exactly, and increasingly people don't listen to each other either. They're just speaking to their own bubble, their own microcosm, and traditional sources of information, legacy media, such as ourselves, I guess, are increasingly denigrated on platforms like X by Elon Musk himself, who has pinned a tweet on his profile. I just had a quick check before coming on air. So with his 206 million followers, and he said, you are the media now, or something like this. So basically telling people, forget the traditional media. Their information, their analysis doesn't count. That's elitist. And so you guys can spread your own information. And it's a huge challenge because increasingly we go to places and we find people who believe something that is factually not correct about a situation which we've been to report on. And so you've got this alternate reality, which is extremely powerful. And people living very close to each other in various countries, I'm not just talking about the US, here in France, exactly the same thing, of people in proximity believing completely different things. And so it's making the public discourse and civilized public discourse much more difficult. And of course, journalists are widely discredited in the eyes of loads and loads of people. So we've got a huge challenge as a profession to try and talk to them. And I think we just have to be more transparent and more honest about our reporting and how we get our sources. It's a bit depressing. Maybe it's too late for that, but we've got to continue trying somehow.
Yeah, legacy is a pejorative, isn't it? It's
yeah,
a term just thrown out. Also interesting to see, at the same time, the rise of the likes of Reddit this week. The old-fashioned forms and Blue Sky starting to appear as well as people come away from the heavy politicisation of it all.
Yeah, but I think Blue Sky is going to become an echo chamber for, you know, liberal people who can't bear to be on X anymore because they just see all these, what they see as extreme right-wing views, some of them are, on there being, you know, boosted by the algorithm. So you're just going to have two different universes.
Bubbles. Katie, has Catherine got a point? It's going to be a liberal platform? Or is that too depressing a thought so that it's a complete bubble?
It is a very depressing thought, but I was nodding along as she was speaking because I think what she's saying is spot on about, you know, first of all, for journalists, the challenge of using facts and reporting and factually accurate information to essentially speak to an audience who believe in a different set of facts, right? Who live in a different reality, one that frankly is not grounded in factual information, but that to them is what's real. So that challenge is something that we feel every single day. You know, I think when it comes to sort of X and Blue Sky and this sort of fracturing of social media platforms and of conversations, I think again, spot on. I think, you know, one of the nuances that I think about with a platform like X is, you know, there's a lot of around, oh, you know, liberals are upset. They're choosing not to use this platform. They don't like who owns it. They don't like seeing sort of points of view that they disagree with. Certainly, I think some of that is true, but I think it's important also to not discount the level of harassment and bullying and toxicity that is happening on X, the platform. And that is sort of a very valid and very credible reason to say, you know what? Everyone has their line. Journalists too have a line, at which point, you know, constant harassment, you know, a constant sort of barrage of threats being leveled against someone on a platform is, I believe, fair grounds and very reasonable grounds to say, I can't participate in this anymore. Yeah. So I think we're seeing a lot of that too, particularly among members of the media.
Katie, we'll see where this goes. We'll see if we can find an ideal place to all meet online. So the other issue this week has become significant in a depressing sense that it's been largely ignored for some time. This time last year, the war in Sudan became known as the war the world forgot. The world leaders focused on the intensity of suffering of the conflicts in Ukraine and Israel. Far less attention paid to stopping Sudan's civil war. This week, international headlines have shifted slightly from calling it forgotten war to an invisible crisis. That's the term the UN is using, declaring it the biggest hunger and displacement crisis in the world. 19 months since the Sudanese army and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Force, turned their weapons on each other and started fighting for control of the country. Aid workers have struggled to get access to areas of desperate need. Peace talks have failed. At the last mediation attempt for the Sudanese army, they didn't turn up. Let's begin with Yasmin. This is not an invisible crisis to you, is it? Something that's affected your family that you have based in Sudan. It must be hard to hear that here we are now 18 months in, it's called still an invisible crisis.
I don't consider it an invisible crisis as much as I consider it invisibilized. I think this is a war that people are aware of. The powers around the world are very aware of it. It's just for a variety of different reasons and different opinions vary on whether it is because it is in Africa and people see this as, you know, the natural state of African people, or whether it's because simply the attentions of the world and world leaders are stretched from Gaza to Ukraine to, you know, politics domestically in the United States. Ultimately, whatever the main or the variety of reasons are, this war has, or the Sudanese people have been betrayed, ultimately. And I can talk about the numbers briefly because, you know, we were here this time last year talking about 6 months in the fact that this was a quote-unquote forgotten war. And we, the Sudanese people, asked, forgotten by who? You know, I was born in Sudan. Most of my family either fled or are still trying to flee. But we're talking, they are of 14 million people, so that's a third of the country's population who are displaced. We're talking immense humanitarian catastrophe. Sudan is a country that has the capacity to feed itself. It grows, it exports food, agriculture, etc. People are literally starving. There has been famine called in various parts of the country, Zemzem camp particularly. However, part of the reason that we can't say there is more widespread famine is because you don't get access in order to collect the data to be able to call it a famine. But we know on the ground the situation. People are dying from starvation and disease. That is now the main reason people are dying. And we're talking about in the numbers that have been killed, the numbers of people that have died, we don't have accurate numbers. We've heard from 40,000 to 60,000 to over 150,000. The fact is we do not know because up to 90% of the medical system hospitals have been destroyed, are inoperable, and the situation is catastrophic. I mean, even just today, I saw a report about Colombian fighters being found, and they had been hired thinking that they were going to work on a project in the UAE and then ferried into Libya and brought in to fight alongside the militia. So we're talking about a landscape now where you've got drones from Iran, you've got Russian involvement, you've got Libyan involvement, you've got the Emirates involvement, you've got all sorts of different players. You've got two enormous, and people might think of this as sort of two generals fighting against each other. That might have been the sort of the initial shots, but ultimately now these are two militarized ecosystems, right, two completely different militarized ecosystems competing over a state, and they will devour the state. At this point, this is a complete humanitarian catastrophe, but also a situation where it is drawing the region, and Sudan is at the intersection of so many different regions, you know, the Middle East, North Africa, the Sahel, the Mediterranean, because it has the Red Sea. It will draw all of these different players in, and it will become and is becoming a landscape for all sorts of unregulated, unmonitored catastrophe.
I mean, there's a couple of issues as to where we are now, Yasmin, as well. So we had Elzedine Al-Safi, who's one of the RSF top negotiators, recently talking to reporters in Nairobi. He told them he didn't think either side could win. He said, in terms of a peace deal, he said it should begin with a ceasefire. We pause, we freeze the lines as they currently are. Now, he might say that because on the other side of that, the Sudanese army seems to think it has momentum right now. And interesting that Tom Perriello, who is the US special envoy, was in Port Sudan, the de facto capital, the army base, for the first time since the war began in the last few days. He said it's down to the generals on the Sudanese army side. There's no sense that he's on the cusp of convincing them to appear at the negotiating table. So as you see, Yasmin, right now, you know, these talks that are going on in Switzerland, could they go anywhere?
The thing that's happening at the moment is many of these generals are essentially forum shopping. They're going from one talk to another, to another, to another, and they're not committing to anything. As you said, sometimes they don't even turn up. And ultimately, what they know is that whatever happens at the diplomatic level is not playing out on the ground. And there is also a structural problem here, because the truth is the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, the militia that Hemeti looks after or is the head of, is actually not a homogenous group. It might, even if, you know, Hemeti and his family members were sort of to say, we are all going to do this, not everyone is marching to the same drumbeat. And the same is happening in the Sudanese armed forces. There are internal tensions, and there is a sort of fight for, as in the RSF, a fight for succession and leadership, and also the Islamists. So the Bashir era operators kind of seeing this as an opportunity to come back to power. So you're not dealing with two homogenous groups that you can have conversations with, where the people at the table represent a sort of organized organization. What you're dealing with is two unstable, hungry groups that are both kind of vying for, but unable to actually look at how they will win militarily. And this is also an important point that I want to underscore. No war in Sudan wars in Sudan do not tend to be won militarily. This is also very political. And so, yes, there might be a call for a ceasefire, but ultimately the ceasefire has to happen alongside a political solution. And all of the political solutions being offered at the moment do not nearly even come close to engaging with the root cause, the root problems here. And so until those, and for that to happen, you need robust engagement from people and countries and states who have actual power. And that's not what we're seeing.
No. Yasmin, we will hopefully continue this conversation when it's less bleak, less depressing, and we will continue it with or without a change in the situation to see where it goes. But right now, since our last conversation, there is not that much more hope than there was, as you say, 6 months ago. Well, to the situation in Germany this week, and a more hopeful situation, at least an attempt to set the record straight, because it is booksellers season right now, and some of the biggest writers have been getting their books out for the Christmas season. One of them is Time magazine's 2015 Person of the Year, Angela Merkel, the former German Chancellor, who released her behind-the-scenes book, a figure lauded initially by many for her welcoming stance on Europe's refugee crisis. Almost a decade on, her legacy hasn't looked as rosy. The headline from The Economist in the last few days was Angela Who, calling out her terrible legacy. So does she do a job in setting that record straight? Let's bring in Katja Hoyer. You've given it 3 stars in The Telegraph. Tell us why.
Well, let's start with the positives. I think it is a book that's worth reading. You do get a sort of behind the scenes look at geopolitics in her time in office. She was the leader of Germany for 16 years and therefore obviously involved in a lot of really, you know, globally significant events. So I found some of her interactions with other foreign leaders really quite revealing. So most people, for instance, know that Vladimir Putin once tried to intimidate her. He knew that she was frightened of dogs, and so he brought his Labrador Coney along to a meeting once to sort of intimidate her with him. But it's less well known that the year before, he already brought a sort of stuffed toy dog along and was griping that basically the dog wouldn't bite her and gave her this huge stuffed toy dog to carry around all day. So these sorts of stories I thought were quite insightful about, you know, the way that foreign leaders interact with one another and also the way that Vladimir Putin behaves. But at the same time, we don't really learn much more about Merkel's internal reflections on her actions, because she just doesn't admit to any regrets or mistakes. There's no kind of reflection on the things that she did while she was in office that reveal any kind of introspection or reevaluation of these things.
In the few seconds we have, to sum it up in a word, is it a tell-all or a say-little?
I think more of a say little. There's certainly very little that will surprise people or give them any sort of new insight into her decision-making processes.
Katja, great to talk to you. Thank you to this week's guests. That's all we have time for. France 24 senior international correspondent Catherine Norris-Trent in London, the writer, broadcaster, social advocate Yasmin Abdul-Magid in Norfolk, as we just heard, the historian, the journalist Katja Hoyer, and also in the US as well, Katie Drummond from Wired magazine. Just time to remember the happier, closer days of the Franco-German relationship, at the time Angela Merkel was mistaken for Mrs. Macron by a French centenarian. We'll see you in 7 days for The World next week.
Elle va avoir 101 ans ?
101 ans après-demain, oui.
Il ne faut pas me faire
pleurer. Avec le petit-fils. Avec le petit-fils. Qu'est-ce qui prend la photo ? Choisis, gars.
Chancelier Allemagne. Chancelier Allemagne.
Regardez. Regardez la photo, photographe.
C'est fantastique.
France's National Rally Party has never been so close to power.
I think time has shown that we were right. We won the battle of ideas.
From the wealthy Riviera to rural France, the far right is reaching out to those wanting change.
Before we were the third wheel, and now we are the fourth wheel. No one plans to take care of us.
To have a migrant shelter for minors is a bit of a blot on the landscape.
And they've found new allies.
The National Rally is not what it used to be. Those who say they're shocked by our alliance aren't really right-wing in my mind, because the National Rally is very respectable nowadays.
A new edition of Reporters on France 24 and France24.com.